Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A new look for some county libraries and a new man at the top at the U.S. Transportation Command, or TRANSCOM. It's got Air Force Base, and that's where we begin. The new TRANSCOM commander is General Darren McDew. He assumed command just about a month ago, and he's no stranger to Scott, having previously commanded the Air Mobility Command there. General McDew takes this assignment at what could be a very critical time in U.S. and U.S. military history. General Darren McDew joins us in studio. General, thanks for being with us, and congratulations on the latest assignment.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here with you today.
You know, the world, as you know, and we all know, is a very dangerous place these days. How does TRANSCOM fit into all of that, all of the troubles that we're seeing in other parts of the world?
Well, one of the things that I get the opportunity to do is to lead, I think, some of the quiet professionals in the Department of Defense. What we do is we touch every single operation the Department of Defense does. So in every one of those volatile regions of the world, U.S. Transportation Command is involved. We like to say the sun never sets on U.S. TRANSCOM.
That's because you're all over the world operating 24/7. Give us a little more detail on what TRANSCOM's mission is.
Well, U.S. Transportation Command has multiple components. We have about 118,000 people split into components. So we've got an Army section of U.S. Transportation Command called the Surface Distribution and Deployment Command. That does all the rail and primarily rail and surface movement. There's an Air Mobility Command piece that's the air component. And then we have a sea component, which is Military Sealift Command.
I think that surprises a lot of people, the fact that the sea comes into the picture in your operation.
I'm excited. I'm learning about boats now. So this airman is learning about ships and how to navigate on the seas.
You are referred to, the command is referred to as kind of the moving company for the Defense Department or for the Pentagon. Is that a good way to put it?
It's a simplistic way to put it. We do moving, but it's an enabling command because it enables a lot of things. If you can think about moving goods and services, that's part of it. But we also provide solutions. Sometimes one of the geographic combatant commanders, say U.S. Central Command or U.S. European Command, needs to know how to do something better in the logistics or distribution or deployment area, and we actually provide solutions for them as well.
With regard to some of those trouble spots that I mentioned before, as best you can and as much as you can, tell me how TRANSCOM is involved, for instance, in the situation in the Middle East involving Iraq, Afghanistan, and then if there's any involvement at all in conjunction with what's going on in Syria.
Well, so first, generically. If there's
no military secrets.
Anytime, anywhere in the world. So generically, if U.S. forces are present, they got there because of U.S. Transportation Command. If U.S. forces are being resupplied, that happens through U.S. Transportation Command, either us generically through our own assets or contracting throughout commercial industry. So in Iraq and Afghanistan, obviously we got the men and equipment and women and equipment there. We're sustaining them. We're resupplying weaponry and that kind of thing. We also do air refueling through our air component. Air medical evacuation is part of U.S. Transportation Command's mission as well. So anybody injured on the battlefield that gets home very rapidly, that's through our network of airplanes as well.
But there is no combat role per se.
We would say that it's all combat, but no firing of weapons.
Although I imagine that some of your equipment has from time to time come under fire itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, just a few hours ago, the remains, unfortunately, of a C-130 crash that happened in theater, those remains just returned home to Dover about 10 o'clock this morning.
Well, that's not a pleasant part of your job, certainly, to have to deal with situations like that. And I'm just going to digress a moment here because of what's happening in Syria. You're an aviator. You had a long career in the service, obviously. I'd just like to get your opinion on what's going on in the skies over Syria right now. We've got Russian planes and American planes fully armed and doing their own thing over there. As a general officer, what's your take on that?
Well, anytime you have, first of all, there's a coalition of people in the skies over Syria. The U.S. and our coalition partners have an air tasking order, which we have a very orchestrated, I would say, almost ballet of who's flying where and when. What concerns me, and obviously concerns the administration, is if the Russians are there as well, and they're not part of that air tasking order, and you don't know where they're flying and what they're bombing, the chance for miscalculation or mistakes can happen.
And that could create an awful environment and an already bad environment.
It is never good.
Yeah. Getting back now to your current role, you've been involved with this kind of operation for most of your career, all of your career, I guess. How does that help you coming into this new job, this new command post?
Well, I would think the entire, as you know, 33 years of service with a myriad of experiences helps you learn faster, helps you relate to different parts of the enterprise, and ask better questions. The fact that I understand how to fly airplanes and how to move goods and equipment around the world is important but not necessarily vital. Mm-hmm. I think what's more important is the fact that I had a chance to serve at the Pentagon several times, serve at the White House, the U.S. Senate, which helps me understand some of the atmospherics surrounding some of the things we do, to be prepared to be ahead of a decision that the government might make so that we're not last, or we're not holding people up.
Is atmospherics another way of saying politics?
No, atmospherics maybe includes politics, but it's all the other things surrounding a decision as well.
What are you seeing, or what is emerging, are emerging as your big challenges now?
The budget. Number one, top of the list for us is the budget. We have got to get to a place in this country where we have a sustainable budget, a predictable budget, delivered on time. And then we've got to deal with the size of the budget. But I think first, consistency is even more important than the size of the budget. When we're dealing with a continuing resolution, there are so many more can'ts involved in a continuing resolution than there are cans. There are certain things you can't do with that budget. You can't plan. You can't modernize. Those things are put in jeopardy anytime you're doing it.
So how does that hurt you? I mean, that's where we are right now.
It is.
With a continuing resolution. How is that affecting you
right
now?
Well, we've got a number of modernization programs out there, a new tanker, air refueling air platform. The KC-46 is on contract now. And it could be in jeopardy if we have to work under a continuing resolution so long that we need to reopen that contract to take another look at it. Mm-hmm. That would be bad for the American taxpayer. Then you can't have new starts with a continuing resolution. So if you needed to start a new modernization program, you can't do it with that kind of budget.
In terms of modernization, where is Transcom with regard to that? I mean, the hardware and the inventory, I'm sure, is aging.
It is. And so we have that in every – just about every facet. So on the air side, which I'm most familiar with, the KC-135 replacement, which the KC-135 is an Eisenhower-era airplane that's been flying well for us for 50-plus years.
Wow.
That we're going to use for another 30 to 40 years. But we've got a recapitalization program that buys us a new airplane. That's one on the air side. On the sea side, we've got aging sea lift ships that will need replacement in the next 10 to 15 years. So we've got to figure out how to do that. And on the surface side, believe it or not, I'm as concerned about roads and bridges in this country as probably the Secretary of Transportation.
Would that the Congress were as concerned as you and the Secretary of Transportation. There certainly needs to be a lot of work there. What about the potential for physical changes at Scott? I'm thinking of BRAC, and I'm thinking of the potential possibly for closing Scott or part of Scott that comes up from time to time. Is that a concern that you have, a realistic concern?
I know it's a question that comes up. I never know what's going to happen in a BRAC round, and I never would predict a BRAC round. I don't believe we need that tool to get to the solution.
BRAC?
Right. Yeah. So the Department of Defense has asked for a BRAC because that's the only tool that we've been able to use through Congress over the last few years to get rid of excess inventory. And we have excess infrastructure in the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
The problem is, prior to BRAC, if anybody remembers, Congress has the ability to close bases. The Department of Defense has the ability to close bases. When we put it into the gonculator called BRAC, we don't know what's going to come out of it.
Yeah.
What if we could just get together and make the prudent decisions we need to make as a nation and make those the right way?
Yeah, for folks who are not familiar with the acronym BRAC, it's base realignment and closure,
right.
And that does come up from time to time. Okay, as long as we're in this part of the conversation, back to the money situation again, because if in fact there's all this uncertainty and nobody seems to get as much as they want anymore, How is that going to affect Scott Air Force Base?
Well, Scott Air Force Base as an installation is in good shape because there have been some prudent decisions along the way to recapitalize some infrastructure there. There's always aging things that need to be replaced. Mm-hmm. The base is about to hit 100 years old in 2017. So you can imagine there's some things that we could, if we could, we'd want to replace. The mission at Scott is fairly secure in that it is the transportation hub. It is a node that is vital, and everybody understands it's vital. So I'm not as concerned about that. But the money to remodernize things, to bring in new technology, to harden us to cyber defenses, all of that is something we ought to be concerned about.
Well, you bring up something that we certainly want to talk about, and you have talked about it since you've taken this assignment, and that is the issue of cybersecurity. This is a big one in today's world.
It absolutely is, and we are, as a nation, not just the Department of Defense, behind a bit in our policies and statutes when it comes to cyber. I'm not sure we fully understand yet this new warfighting domain and what it will mean going forward. We don't know, what does it mean, for example, to be at war in cyberspace? I'm not sure I understand. I don't think our work in the Department of Defense and the work that the Department of Homeland Security is doing with this commercial networks are as completely aligned as we'd all want them to be. So those are some of my concerns as we go forward, because I operate in both spheres.
Well, I guess a lot of folks are really concerned about that. And on the operational level, you're dealing with, as you mentioned before, ports and vessels and that sort of thing. And you're dealing with private contractors who are helping out. Security in these areas is something that I think would be of immense concern to someone like yourself.
It is. Right now, 90% of our work at U.S. Transportation Command is done with our commercial partners and their networks. So I'm obviously very concerned that if I contract with an organization that they have, their security is tight. I know where my security is, but I'm not sure where theirs is. And if I were an adversary, I wouldn't go after the hardened target. I would go after a softer target. And so right now, some of our commercial industry teammates are a softer target than I am.
Again, there are certain things I know you can't talk about, but I'm curious as to how the military is working on this. There must be units separate and apart that are working on this 24/7.
Absolutely. Yeah. U.S. Cyber Command in the Department of Defense is obviously has the lead for the Department of Defense. The Department of Homeland Security has the lead for the commercial side of the United States. They are, in fact, talking to each other. I want to work somewhere in the seam between the two because I'm one of the few combatant commanders that is as concerned about the commercial side as I am the DOD side.
Yeah, you're in a somewhat unique position in that regard. We have to take a break. Our guest is General Darren McDew. He's the TRANSCOM commander at Scott Air Force Base. That's the U.S. Transportation Command. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. If you have questions for the general or questions with regard to what TRANSCOM does and how it does it, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. We'll take an email at talk at stlpublicradio.org. If you'd like to send us a tweet, we'll take that at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with General Darren McDew. What about the humanitarian role of TRANSCOM?
You know, we have the opportunity to impact lives of people we'll actually never meet personally. And if you talk to some of our youngest in the command, our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, that 118,000 that are active duty guard and reserve, many of them will say that supporting the war effort is duty. It is memorable to do a humanitarian operation.
And the big one, I guess, before your time here was the Ebola crisis in Africa. What exactly was the involvement there?
Well, U.S. Transportation Command actually had people on the ground in Liberia and some other African countries supporting the onload and offload of equipment and personnel We also worked with a local company to devise a system to move large infected groups of people. And we call that the TIS, the Transportation Isolation System, I believe is the acronym. We have enough acronyms. Yeah. I can acronym you to death this morning. system allows us, in any infectious disease environment, bring in more than one patient, have them isolated in this container that slides into the back of a C-17. You can bring the hospital in there and then bring it out and still have the C-17 not affected.
Not contaminated.
Right.
And that was something that was just developed and devised as a result of the Ebola crisis, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And it was showed the great innovation that's going on at U.S. Transportation Command and the work with local commercial businesses.
How does that work? I mean, how do people in Africa who are confronting a crisis like Ebola manage to have your planes come in there and help bring some of these infected folks out?
Well, it is the story of the world. We in this country are blessed enough that we can help in a lot of places. And when folks are in trouble around the world, they do call on the United States of America. And we're one of the few that can and will. And our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines will come up with a solution to meet a need we didn't know we would have.
They work through diplomatic channels.
Absolutely.
Then, and then it funnels through the system until it gets to
eventually to
your
desk. Cornfields of Illinois.
The cornfields of Illinois. On the humanitarian issue, let's bring in a caller. Michael is joining us from St. John. Michael, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with General McDew.
It's my pleasure. And first, I'd like to congratulate the general on his relatively recent assumption of command. But I also wanted to ask a question. Back in, I think it was 1996, I had the privilege of working with the Air Force under a program that was called the Denton Program in Honduras that allowed for the transport of humanitarian aid and personnel to come and help rebuild after Hurricane Mitch. So the question I have for the general is if the Denton program is still active or still utilized, and also for the benefit of our listeners, if he could describe some recent examples of the Denton program being used to assist other countries following humanitarian or natural disasters.
The Denton Amendment is still active. It is codified in statute. And we are still able to use it on a need basis or an availability basis. And I would say it was probably most recently used in Nepal. I don't have a specific example from Nepal, but routinely when crises happen around the world, the American public and all of our not-for-profit organizations come together and meet the need. And some of them reach out through the Denton process for us to transit goods and equipment overseas.
I'm not sure I understand what the Denton process is.
The Denton Amendment was, I can't remember, it was named after the author of the legislation, mm-hmm. and it allows us to use government airplanes and I guess any lift process to move non-government equipment free of charge.
All right. Well, Michael?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, I thought you were getting ready to follow up your question. Do you have more?
I believe it was actually named after a senator that introduced that legislation.
Yeah.
And it, as the general said, it does provide for the transport of humanitarian aid. And I think it's a wonderful program. And I wanted to be sure that, one, that it was actually still being utilized, as you said, codified, also I wanted our listeners to be aware that Transcom does a lot of humanitarian work, as he had earlier alluded to regarding the assistance relative to Ebola.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for the call, Michael. We did chat about that for a moment or two before you came with us. Another call, Ron joins us from St. Louis. Ron, you're on the air with General McDew.
I just wanted to compliment the general on the work he does in the community with youth. He's been very involved with First Lego League Robotics. He's been involved with the National Society of Black Engineers. He's helped motivate thousands of young people to look at the military as a career and also to go into the STEM fields, which we definitely need, especially with cybersecurity. So I would like to say keep up the good work, and we know you do an excellent job of taking care of your troops. Thank you.
You can respond to him, General, if you would like.
Thank you very much. It probably gives me far too much credit. I and my bride of nearly 32 years are just committed to giving back, trying to give back as much as we've been given in our lifetime.
Well, that's an important part of all of our roles, is it not? I'd like to talk about a little bit more in detail about the sea lift role, if you will, and the rail role. Again, we always think, when we think of TRANSCOM and the Air Mobility Command, for instance, we think of airplanes.
You bet.
You mentioned that you have to learn an awful lot about things nautical these days in your new job. What exactly is the operation like?
The operation is we in this country have a sea lift business that is diminishing over time. I would say prior to 9/11, it was in jeopardy of maybe not being around in the way we would need it going forward. Post 9/11 and all the movement of goods and equipment to Afghanistan and Iraq probably bolstered the industry and helped keep it afloat, no pun intended. Mm-hmm. And today what we're finding is we only have about 79 or so commercial or vessels that are U.S. flagged that we can use for government and military work. That's starting to get to the bare bones ability to, in the crisis, what will we use to move that kind of equipment?
What kind of equipment is typically moved by vessel?
Everything from Humvees to helicopters to household goods sometimes. But in the times of war, if you can think of any large pieces of equipment that the military might have, you can put lots of them on a ship versus a few of them on an airplane. Much cheaper. And can be quick.
But can be quick?
Can be, depending on what you're talking about. So if you want to move, say, 400 containers, mm-hmm. you can move them today on a C-17. And by the time you use those C-17s back and forth, how many will you get to point B versus if you had the time to put 400 of them on one container ship and move them? It may take you 2 weeks to get there, but you'll have 400 containers there in 2 weeks.
And we're not talking about the U.S. Navy here. We're talking about commercial operations.
The primarily commercial operations.
Once again, bringing in this whole notion of security and having to manage that, it just seems like a mind-boggling process.
Well, luckily, I'm not the only one doing this work. Remember, there are 118,000 very talented, very smart, and with all their synapses still firing, people that do this work. And there are some really experienced people, and obviously the Department of Transportation has a maritime administration that also plays a role in this, a very heavy role in this.
Right. What about the rail transportation component?
The rail component, my surface component, SDDC, Surface Deployment and Distribution Command, they manage that primarily. But if you would look at the rail industry, it seems to be fairly sound. I've not visited them yet. Mm-hmm. I have visited some seaports. We have two major seaports, one on the West Coast and one on the East Coast, that are in need of repair. That's another thing the budget is hampering us on right now, is how do we get those repairs to those strategic seaports so that we can outload the U.S. Army and other equipment in times of crisis.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you, if we may, for a moment. You've mentioned earlier some of the previous assignments that you've had, including Senate, I think you said, and the White House. Tell us about your work in both of those venues.
Well, for a young man who didn't even know how he was going to go to college, to get a chance to, through the Air Force ROTC 4-year scholarship program, to get a degree in civil engineering, I couldn't even have imagined one day working as the aide to the President of the United States at the White House and running the Air Force's Senate liaison office in the Russell Building on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. And so those were remarkable opportunities for me to broaden in understanding the federal government.
And with which president were you working?
President Clinton's first term.
Right. And the job involved what?
It was multifaceted. The primary role of the aide to the president is to carry the nuclear football. And so your primary job is emergency actions for the president. There were some other jobs. I joked with the president when he was trying to look his most presidential, my job was to look my most military. Right. I had a ceremonial role as we traveled around the world. And then you work as an operations officer and kind of detailing some of the things that happened at the White House. Most Americans don't understand that, of course, Air Force One and Marine One, but the president doesn't call them directly. He works through the staff, and a lot of times on the road that would be the military aide.
I can't imagine the feeling of responsibility one has carrying that nuclear football. I mean, that's the box, I guess. If you have to pull the trigger, that's where it happens.
It's something. Right. Yeah, the president's emergency satchel is the formal name.
And how big a satchel is it?
It's big. but you wouldn't want me to get too classified.
It's
not actually that big. It's as big as a satchel. You can see it if you pay particular attention on television. You will see a military officer lagging a little bit with a briefcase.
It's not something you take home with you, is it?
No, not at night.
What about the Senate job, the Russell Building?
The Senate job was an opportunity for me to brag about the United States Air Force to the members of Congress and be a liaison with them to answer some of the questions that they may have about not just the Air Force but the Department of Defense. There are many times that they want to frame a question but don't know how to ask it. They may want an answer but don't know where to go. And so that was one of the jobs that I did in the Senate.
Right. Most interesting career, needless to say. I'm sure you're looking forward to the months and years ahead. How long typically would this assignment be? 2 years, 3 years?
About 2 years, 3 years. I serve at the pleasure of. And so someday someone will tap me on the shoulder and say, you know, General, we found you out now and it's time for you to go do something else.
Well, probably something even more important than what you're doing right now. I want to thank you so much, General, for being with us. Is there anything you want to add with regard to the job you have at Transcom that we haven't discussed?
Well, it is a fascinating job. But the thing I get to do is brag about the quiet professionals who do this job. And on any given day, there are 1,000 rail cars being moved, loaded, and offloaded, 1,000 trucks, 1,400 sets of household goods, about 500 to 600 sorties flown around the world. It's an amazing enterprise, but it's only amazing because of the great Americans who make it work.
And you're the first African American to hold this position, and that's an honor and a privilege, I'm sure, in and of itself.
It is. It's unfortunate we're still having firsts at this day and age, but I'm the guy.
Well, you got to have the first before you can move on. The journey of 1,000 miles. Single step and all of that.
Absolutely.
General Darren McDude, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations once again on this new assignment, and hope we can talk with you again about the many things that Transcom is doing.
Anytime. Thank you.
It has been a great pleasure indeed. Coming up, we'll take a new look at several facilities in the St. Louis County Library System. That's coming up in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.